Court appointed is meant to be for entertainment purposes and basic legal information only.
Nothing in this podcast should be considered as legal representation nor legal advice.
Only use the knowledge presented herein to dazzle your friends or possibly win bar trivia.
Dr. Lawyer, idiot chief. For my life with songs of grief, with the yellow fear and fearless eyes. His temper all the times, the times I've tried.
Hello, and this is Court Appointed. I'm your co-host and future law student interested in all things legal and illegal, Riley Smurl.
And I'm your other co-host, Tommy Smurl, and I am just her dad. Well, Riley, here we are again.
Here we are.
Here we are, doing another Court Appointed.
Yet again.
Yet again. Well, and you've had a very busy week finishing up.
My last year.
Last year, my last baby.
Well, you've got Charlie and Cooper.
Well, they're my grandbabies.
They got a ways to go.
I don't have to raise them. Sydney and Justin have to do something with them. Well, I don't have to do it all.
That's true. That's true.
Well, we had a topic that was suggested to us by one of our listeners, Kenny Fichter, and he wanted to know, can you hide in a church and to seek sanctuary from the police? And can they enter the church and arrest you if you're in there?
Mm-hmm.
So the answer to that is, yes, they can.
Yep.
So thank you for listening to Court Appointed.
That's it.
That's all, folks. Well, no, that wouldn't be very fun, would it?
No.
We should go into more detail than that, shouldn't we?
Yes. So go ahead. Well, how do we get started talking about sanctuary in a church?
Well, here's the thing. That's kind of a common misconception. But the thing is, it's not like that. This was never the case, because actually, religious sanctuary began long before Christianity, and it was used in ancient Greece and Rome to designate places, bestowing a degree of sacredness on those who entered it. Sometimes the sanctuary zone was an altar or a temple, and sometimes it was an entire town. Now, the Bible in several places discusses the right to sanctuary for accidental homicides. I don't know. I accidentally cut the guy's head off. he walked in my path, but it was the right to sanctuary for accidental homicides in order to prevent vengeance killings. So that was one of the reasons that they had it, was so that, you know, they didn't go over and string the guy up before people calmer heads could prevail and they investigate this thing and say, oh, it was just an accident.
Mm-hmm.
Now, other cultures sometimes designated natural areas as sanctuary, such as woods or lakes. And the Romans had problems with folks overusing sanctuaries and tried several times to limit or abolish the concept, but sanctuary eventually became established in canon and secular law. Belief in religious sanctuary spread throughout Western civilization, although different cultures had different ways of enforcing it. The Germans obliged the fugitive to surrender if the authorities promised to forego capital punishment, whereas the Carolingians denied sanctuary for those under death sentence. The English went whole hog with the concept, though. They went beyond the basic sanctuary provided by any church, and they used royal charters to create sanctuary zones extending a mile in all directions around certain abbeys, with roadside stone crosses marking the boundaries. So depending on the place, fugitives might have to grab a certain door knocker and sit in a designated stone chair or ring a special bell or wear particular clothing to indicate they sought protection. In most cases, weapons had to be checked at the door.
Wow.
So you paint your certain suit and grab the door knocker and say, na 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 boo boo, you can't catch me.
It doesn't sound like it should have been real.
But the English had all kinds of fun. The English are a fun people. They put all these special rules in place to do it.
Yeah. And I mean, that was part of their law. It was recognized in English law for 13 centuries up until the 17th century that if you were in a sacred place, you were immune to arrest.
That's right. But now it rarely meant that you had permanent immunity from prosecution, and it never applied to religious crimes. So in canon law, it protected those accused of violent crimes for a limited time only, affording a measure of due process in a time when punishment was often very abrupt and bloody.
Yes.
So in England, claimants were generally allowed just 40 days of protection, after which they had to surrender or go into exile. You know, if I was accused of a bloody crime, I might want to go into exile. Mm-hmm. That might be okay. Now, sanctuary was often violated. Sometimes civil authorities would cut off food supplies to the church, storm it, or set it on fire to force the issue. Nonetheless, something like 1,000 people a year took refuge in churches throughout most of English history. We're going to smoke them out of there.
Yeah.
All right, you don't have to come out. That's fine, but you know, when the torches start coming in the back window, you might want to reconsider.
Yeah.
Now, as the power of the church waned, so did the protection of sanctuary. So in the 15th century, Edward IV dragged the Duke of Somerset and 20 of his men from a church and beheaded them. That was pretty abrupt. In 1623, James I abolished sanctuary for criminal offenses, and in 1697, William III did the same for civil offenses. Other Western European countries followed suit. In the U.S., religious sanctuary has never been recognized in state or federal law. And the only legal equivalent in most places now is the granting of political asylum in embassies and consulates. But this hasn't stopped people from claiming sanctuary, although it was ill-advised. GIs occasionally sought sanctuary during the Vietnam War. The most publicized episode took place in Honolulu in 1969 when dozens of AWOL servicemen and their supporters fled to local churches, possibly inspired by a similar movement in Boston the prior year. After giving the unwilling soldiers a couple of weeks to change their minds, the MPs ended up raiding the churches, breaking down the doors, and dragging them out.
Wow.
And thus they returned to military service. Actually, mm-hmm. They were just thrown into military prison.
Well, that makes more sense.
During investigation of the Tawana Brawley rape case in New York in the late 1980s, Brawley's mother claimed sanctuary at a series of Baptist churches to avoid testifying before a grand jury. Police, presumably to avoid inflaming the African-American community, made no move to grab her, and eventually she fled the state. So people have still tried it from time to time, but like I said, it has never been a thing in American law.
Nope. Although I did, so while this is not something in our written law, you know, you can be arrested in a church, you can be, they can enter a church, police officers can just enter a church if they need to. There's something I read about called the hot pursuit exception, where if the police are actively in pursuit of a criminal, they can enter anywhere without a warrant. Doesn't matter, including churches. But one of the things that's become an issue discussed in conjunction with sanctuary is immigrants, undocumented immigrants, taking sanctuary in churches and churches opening their doors to undocumented immigrants offering sanctuary. Even though this isn't a legal protection, they still can be arrested or deported or taken into custody, all those things in a church. But I guess there's the idea that it's a bad look for police departments to go into a church and arrest undocumented immigrants that are just there for, you know, sanctuary.
Bless me, Father, for I have sinned. I'm about to drag these people to deport them from this country.
Yeah, that's like what CNN described it as. Being able to arrest an undocumented immigrant in a church is one thing, but doing so is a whole other thing. So, you know.
Yeah, they said that's become bigger in recent years, and a lot of people not knowing what else to do because of immigration violations have been fleeing to churches. And a church can play a role as a sanctuary in a wide range of circumstances, including protecting victims of domestic violence or shielding minors from abusers and simply providing a warm place to sleep during freezing weather. But a church is not, as a general rule, a place where suspected criminals can successfully hide. Now, there's a legal side of that question, but there's also a cultural dimension. Media reports have indicated that federal immigration and customs enforcement officials have been reluctant to arrest suspected undocumented immigrants who have sheltered in churches. This is almost certainly because of the potential backlash from the community, which probably doesn't understand the nature of sanctuary churches.
Yeah.
Now, harboring a suspected criminal, though, could be a crime. Church leaders must give careful consideration to the potential consequences for the church and its personnel before offering sanctuary to someone who is running from law enforcement. Harboring a criminal is often also a criminal offense punishable by jail time. For example, Federal immigration law provides that harboring undocumented immigrants in any place is a crime. Anyone who knowingly gives assistance to a fugitive may be subject to arrest and prosecution, and the church itself may be subject to criminal fines. So the decision to offer such support should be made only by the church's board and only after examining all the facts.
Although ICE has said that they generally tend to avoid arrests at what they call sensitive locations, which includes places of worship, because they said they don't want to basically discourage anyone from pursuing services or participating in activities in sensitive places like churches, probably, I don't know, shelters, hospitals, those kind of places that have good resources for people. They don't like to arrest people there, but even though they have the legal ability to do so.
Well, at this time, we would like to approach the bench to pay for court costs.
Who is it?
Who is it?
Who is it?
Who is it, you say?
Who is it?
It is a new sponsor, Magic Spoon. Now, growing up, cereal was one of the best parts of being a kid. But I had to give it up because I realized it was full of sugar and junk that you really shouldn't eat. And I mean, I love cereal. I eat lots of bowls of cereal. Not just as a kid, but as a grown-up too. But I've been trying to cut down on the carbs, sugar, unhealthy food, and realized I basically can't eat anything anymore, especially cereal. So I've been drinking protein shakes and powder for years, but finally found a delicious way to get my protein before and after workouts.
And how is that?
We're all trying to eat better, but healthy breakfast doesn't have to be boring. Magic Spoon has the amazing flavors you love, but without all the bad stuff.
That's right. Only has, 4 net grams of carbs in each serving, 0 grams of sugar, 13 to 14 grams of protein, only 140 calories a serving, and it's keto, gluten-friendly, grain-free, soy-free, low-carb, and GMO-free.
Now, they have a variety pack with 4 different flavors that are cocoa, fruity, frosted, and peanut butter. I've had all 4, and they're all 4 delicious.
They are.
You can even take the cocoa and the peanut butter and mix it together and make a kind of Reese cup cereal if you want.
Although my favorite is the fruity.
Fruity's good. The frosted's good, too.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what we'd like you to do is go to magicspoon.com/court to grab a variety pack and try it today. And be sure to use our promo code court at checkout to save $5 off your order.
And Magic Spoon is so confident in their product, it's backed with a 100% happiness guarantee. So if you don't like it for any reason, they'll refund your money with no questions asked.
I like happiness guarantees.
Mm-hmm.
So remember, get your next delicious bowl of guilt-free cereal at magicspoon.com/court and use the code court to save $5 off. And thank you, Magic Spoon, for sponsoring this episode. Now, when we talk about sanctuary, one of the things we have to understand where the whole concept comes from is the Fourth Amendment, as far as the United States. The Fourth Amendment says the right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable search and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrant shall issue but upon probable cause supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the person or things to be seized. So the Fourth Amendment is what keeps like police from just coming into your house whenever they want and just kind of looking around at random.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't mean under certain circumstances that they can't in a way do that.
Right.
So one of them was what you talked about there earlier was the hot pursuit doctrine.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in the hot pursuit doctrine, it says that if the police are pursuing a subject because they have violated the law and they enter a building, a public building, such as a church or a business or whatever, you don't have to get permission. You can go on in and you can arrest them.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what follows in along with that is the plain view doctrine. A police officer doesn't need a warrant to seize contraband or evidence that is in plain view if the officer is legitimately in the area where the evidence or contraband is first spotted. so the officer must have probable cause to believe the item is evidence or contraband in order to seize it. So if an officer who has lawfully pulled you over what appears to be cocaine on the passenger seat, he can probably examine it, seize it, and arrest you. And that comes from Supreme Court ruling in Coolidge v. New Hampshire, and also one involving Arizona v. Hicks. But so if you're going into a church, say, and you're an undocumented immigrant, and they follow you into that church, and they come across other undocumented immigrants, guess what? They're going to check them out, too. So you've just blown it for everybody.
Yeah. I had to research a very somewhat similar case that had to do with the Fourth Amendment. And it was a Supreme Court case from 1967 called Camara v. Municipal Court for a class I was just in this semester. And it was about a person, Camara, who was leasing the bottom floor of a building that the housing code said it was not able to be used as a residential space because of the building's occupancy limits. So the city inspectors tried to enter the building without a search or without a warrant for a search. And they charged him with violating the city's housing code because he refused a search of his house without a warrant, which then he won because, you know.
Because you do have to have a warrant.
You do have to have a warrant.
Right.
But although this was not his decision in his favor until the Supreme Court, because the lower courts thought there was constitutional to have warrantless searches because there are housing ordinances in place that allow searches under the Constitution if it's an inspection that is, quote, limited in scope and may not be exercised under unreasonable conditions. So kind of broad wording there. It went back to Frank v. Maryland. That was another Supreme Court decision. But since then, they've decided that warrantless searches are generally not allowed.
That was what happened with the Breonna Taylor when she got killed.
Yes. Although they did have a warrant.
Oh, that was, that's right.
But it was a no-knock warrant.
No-knock warrant. That's what that was. That was different.
Yeah.
My mistake.
It's still not good, but
it still
technically a
chaos.
Kind of warrant. Yeah.
Now, there is some exceptions, other exceptions to needing a warrant. A search can be made in connection with an arrest. A police officer doesn't need a warrant to conduct a search incident to an arrest. After a lawful arrest, an officer has a right to search the arrestee and the area within the arrestee's immediate control. That's in United States v. Robinson. Police may sometimes also make what's known as a protective sweep of the premises following an arrest. They can sweep if they have reason to suspect that a dangerous accomplice might be hiding in the area in question. Even without that kind of suspicion, they typically may look in spaces immediately next to the area of the arrest that could hold a hidden attacker. A protective sweep is supposed to be limited to a cursory visual inspection of places where an accomplice might be hiding. For example, police officers can often look under beds and inside closets. If a sweep is lawful, the police can seize contraband or evidence of crime that is in plain view during the sweep, but the sweep must be aimed at protecting the officers, not gathering evidence.
The idea of being in plain view has always been something that in procedural TV shows has always been funny to me, because sometimes you'll have police officers that, you know, or things are in plain view, sitting on top of a counter, maybe in the middle of a room, something like that. But lots of times in those TV shows, there's a lot of stretching that definition of plain view and just prying something a little bit open, saying, well, it's right there. But that's, I mean,
well, that's dramatic purposes.
Not allowed. Well, yeah, I'm just saying. I feel like that's one of those things that in TV, they always get pretty wrong.
Now, one other one that falls under the same thing is the emergency exception. As a general rule, the police are authorized to conduct a warrantless search when the time it would take to get a warrant would jeopardize public safety or lead to the loss of important evidence. Here are some of the situations in which most judges would uphold a warrantless search. Following a street drug arrest, an officer enters the house after the suspect shouts into the house, "Eddie, quick, flush it!" The officer arrests Eddie and seizes the stash. This is the example they gave.
I don't think anyone's actually going to do that.
Eddie, flush it.
I got to say, I don't think anyone would do that in front of a police officer.
That's an example. A police officer on a routine patrol hears shouts and screams coming from a residence. He rushes in and arrests a suspect for spousal abuse. So that would be the reason why he's able to enter your house. A police officer is in hot pursuit, and that's what we discussed, of a fleeing felon. So he continues the chase into the suspect's dwelling in order to make the arrest. In these types of emergency situations, an officer's duty to protect people and preserve evidence outweighs the warrant requirement. That's United States v. Santana or Cup v. Murphy. That has nothing to do with Murphy's Law.
No, it's not the same.
Now, I was looking for one of the most famous cases that involved sanctuary.
Mm-hmm.
And what I came across, and I don't know if you've heard of this or not. Now, I heard of a movie that was called this, but the movie was not based on the actual incident. It's called The War of the Roses.
I have not heard of this.
Well, there's a movie called that, but that's about a man and a woman that are getting divorced, and it's not the same thing. The War of the Roses was actually the 15th century when the Lancastrians of Yorkists would suddenly gain the upper hand by winning a battle, and some adherents of the losing side might find themselves surrounded by adherents of the winning side and unable to return to their own side. So they would rush to sanctuary at the nearest church until it was safe to leave it. A prime example is Queen Elizabeth Woodville, consort of Edward IV of England. In 1470, when the Lancastrians briefly restored Henry VI to the throne, Edward's queen was living in London with several young daughters. She moved them into Westminster Abbey for sanctuary, living there in royal comfort until Edward was restored to the throne in 1471, and giving birth to their first son, Edward, during that time. When King Edward IV died in 1483, Elizabeth, who was highly unpopular even with her own Yorkists and probably did need protection, took her five daughters and youngest son, Richard the Duke of York, and Prince Edward had his own household by then, and again moved into the sanctuary at Westminster Abbey. She had all the comforts of home. She brought so much furniture and so many chests that the workmen had to break holes in some of the walls to move everything in fast enough to suit her.
Wow.
But, as you can see, that there's a term asylum that's used there, too. And the concepts of sanctuary and asylum are defined very similarly at their most basic level. Both terms involve the granting of safety or protection from some type of danger. It's often implied to be a persecuting or oppressive power. The divergence between these two terms stems primarily from their societal associations and legal standing. While asylum, understood in its political sense, implies legally binding protection on the part of a state entity, sanctuary often takes the form of moral and ethical activism that calls into question decisions made by the institutions in power. So there's a little bit of difference in there, but they're sometimes used interchangeably.
Yeah. I mean, we have recognized asylum laws and statutes in the United States, although I guess technically not sanctuary.
Right. Yeah. So. Like I say, the only thing really binding these days would be when people seek political asylum at a embassy or something.
Right.
And that's often because they feel like if they get returned to their home country or something like that, they would be killed for their crimes or because it was a corrupt government or something.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, that's the issue right now, right? With people trying to enter the United States seeking asylum from their countries, not because they're, fleeing from any sort of criminal prosecution, but more so just danger and safety reasons.
Exactly.
Well, is it time for
legal briefs? Yes, it is. And this week, I'm going to turn the table on you most of the investigating.
Yes, you did.
Well, what are the two doctrines that we learned that have to do with warrantless searches?
Two doctrines have to do with warrantless searches.
Yes, that make warrantless searches okay. What two doctrines did we hear about?
Is one of them the hot pursuit one?
That is one of them. Which says
that if they're in active pursuit of a criminal, they can, continue to pursue that criminal.
Inner facilities, whatever it is,
wherever they
go.
Yeah. Yes.
All right. And what was the other one?
I know it was the one that had to do with the guy shouting, "Eddie, flush him," right?
Well, what we were actually looking for
I don't know what it's called.
Was the plain view doctrine.
Plain view. where something's just in plain view of where you are while a crime is being investigated,
or
right?
While you're making an arrest. Yeah, you're making a legal arrest that you actually saw it, and you're making a legal arrest, and then you're able to look around the area, and you're even able to perform what other kind of look if you're arresting someone?
What, I mean?
A protective sweep.
Oh, yes.
Of the area. So if anybody else might be hiding that could do you harm or things like that.
Right.
So, and if you come across any kind of contraband or illegal stuff during that, that's okay to seize that as well.
And that had to do with protecting the general safety.
Of the police officers, yes.
Of the police officers.
Right. Now, what was the 15th name of the 15th century war that we talked about?
Of the one of the roses?
Yes.
The
War of the Roses. That's it. Yes. Evidently, there was a very unpopular queen that kept getting moved in and out of the castle, and then she would run to Westminster Abbey, which always makes me think of that old song. Westminster Abbey and the Tower Big Ben and the rosy red cheeks of the little children.
I don't know that one.
You don't know that one?
I don't know that one.
England swings like the pendulum do. Bobby's on bicycles two by two. Westminster Abbey and the Tower Big Ben and the rosy red cheeks of the little children.
Yeah, no, even if you say it again, I still don't know it.
But it's such a catchy tune. I don't really know what it was about. I guess it was. I don't know.
I don't know.
But it was one of those Henrys that was before number 8 that was involved in there. There was a Henry the 6th and a Henry the 4th, and evidently they had troubles. And Henry the 8th, of course, he just had woman trouble.
Well, yeah, he had 6 wives.
Yeah, that's woman trouble.
And what? One of them ended up beheaded and divorced 2 of them, and another one died. I don't know. There's a whole musical about it.
He had 99 problems, but a woman wasn't one.
Well, actually, I think 6 of them were a woman.
Thanks to everybody for listening, and thanks to MCRB for use of their song, Dr. Lawyer Indian Chief.
We're proud to be coming to you almost live from Smurl Studios, high atop Three Last Mountain.
And we want to thank Audio Boom for being a part of their network.
And we also want to thank the McElroy Stable of Podcasts for helping give us our start. Their podcasts include Bim Bam, Sawbones, Still Buffering, and many other fine offerings.
If you have the chance, take the time to rate and review us on iTunes, especially if you like us. And if you didn't, don't bother.
You're not supposed to say that.
You're going to edit that out though, aren't you?
Why? You never did.
Thanks for listening. This has been Court Appointed. I'm your co-host, Mike Meadows. I'm a lawyer and a dude.
And I'm your other co-host, Tommy Smurl. And I am just a dude. Hello, welcome to Tommy's Random Thought. Today's Random Thought is the Governor of West Virginia. Big Jim Justice is the Governor of West Virginia. He is kind of like our own mini version of Donald Trump. I say mini only in terms of wealth and national exposure because the guy is 6'7" and well over 300 pounds. So when I say miniature, I don't mean physically. He is like Trump in the way he was a businessman turned politician. They both ran for the first time for their respective chosen office and won. Justice actually ran as a Democrat, but when the state of West Virginia went so heavily for Trump, something like 85%, he quickly figured it was better to be a Republican. So he changed after being elected as a Democrat to a Republican within a few months of getting elected. Like Trump, Justice is a billionaire. He made his money off of farming and coal. He is recognized as the biggest farmer east of the Mississippi. He owned many coal mines in not only West Virginia, but also Kentucky and Virginia. He has established a pattern of not paying his vendors, or fines, or really anything he owes. He makes everyone sue him and then draws these things out in court because a lot of the people he stiffs don't have the finances to be tied up in court for years and try to get their rightful money. He does the same thing with states that have fined his companies. They finally offer a greatly reduced amount to get him to pay something after years and years of litigation, but it's pennies on the dollar. The historic Greenbrier Resort went into bankruptcy, and he bought that up. It once held a secret underground bunker where they would fly the president and staff to go in case of a nuclear attack. It is a beautiful resort that is world-renowned, even if it is in West Virginia. He brought a PGA event there, but a few years ago, about a month ahead of that event, a large flooding event occurred in that area and wiped out roads and the golf course and lots of people and houses. He got millions from the federal government in emergency funds to put people's lives back together from the flood. But in typical good old boy fashion, he picked an old friend or crony, as it were, to handle the money distribution. When several years later, none of the houses were rebuilt, only the Greenbrier had been restored, investigative reporters wanted to know why. Seems his old buddy kept most of the money for himself. Good old boys. So in short, his financial dealings are very dubious. Now let's look at his political acumen. His first year in office, he didn't like the budget that he was given by the legislative body that goes through this exercise every year, and he never has, and I don't think he even understands what a budget is. He brought in a silver platter with a silver dome over it to the joint session on the budget. He said, "This is what you people do. You present your budget like it's all beautiful and wonderful on the outside, but inside, it's this." He opened the dome, and it was an actual platter of bullsh stuff, if you know what I mean. Wow, what class, carrying that into the Capitol. Even though he is a governor, he still coaches the high school girls basketball team from his hometown that he still lives in, because he doesn't like living in Charleston, where the Capitol is. He finds his own house more comfortable than the governor's mansion. This caused another lawsuit to try and get him to move there as prescribed by West Virginia Constitution. Recently, he promoted and got passed a law forbidding transgender girls from competing in sports at any level, K through college. He says he is protecting girls. He seems to think that boys are just putting on wigs so they can go win trophies or ribbons or something that belong to girls. When this bill was being debated, the question was asked, how many examples of this occurred in West Virginia last year? The answer is zero. Oh, but we need a law just in case? It is specifically aimed at transgender females because transgender males, well, they're girls. They can't compete with boys anyway, so they think. Total ignorance. His next executive brilliance was to try and eliminate state income tax completely. This, he says, will make people flock to West Virginia. The problem was he was going to raise taxes on everything else, including services that are not even taxed at all right now. We would have the highest sales tax rate in the country, and the increase on beer would have completely tanked the growing craft beer industry that has just recently taken off here. The only ones that would benefit would be very rich people. Everyone else would have been much, much worse off. I think he was just looking out for himself. That was why he was so angry when it failed to pass. His most recent faux pas was his efforts to encourage the 50% of the state that won't get vaccinated, out of ignorance, to get the vaccine. He offered a crisp $100 savings bond to everyone that got the vaccine. It was his own idea. Invest in the health of the state and your country at the same time, he said. It's something you can see, you can hold in your hand and take a picture with. The U.S. government stopped issuing actual paper bonds in 2012. Well, I mean, it would have been a good idea if you people weren't so picky. Great thought there, Jim. Have you ever heard of Google? No wonder we have lost 60,000 people from our state and are now losing a congressional seat. And what's really sad is that neither party can seem to find anyone any better than Big Jim. This has been Tommy's Random Thought.